Would somebody call me Peter Parker before I go insane? You see, this other guy that I've been lately forgot he had a name. I find super strength and fame ain't all that they're cracked up to be. 'Cause the only one that they don't help is me. And the spider's web flew through the air, and it landed on Peter Parker.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lax.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff. This time on the show, we are talking about Spider-Man 3. It is not the best Spider-Man thing you can go out and experience this week, but we have been doing a retrospective series on the original Sam Raimi Spider-Man films from the early 2000s. In honor of Insomniac's new amazing Spider-Man game on the PS4. That game is finally out, and earlier this week we did an episode giving our first impressions, spoiler-free, of that game. We love it. Go listen to that episode. We talk about it a lot. Next week we're going to talk about it a lot more in spoiler detail. But we want to finish this retrospective series, so as a bonus episode this week, we are also recording our thoughts on Spider-Man 3, the black sheep of the Spider-Man franchise, which we both rewatched this week for the first time in years. How long had it been since you saw it, Sean?
Jeez. When did we do that podcast? Because didn't we do a podcast talking about these?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that had to have been the last time I watched it.
Yeah, so
I certainly have not seen it since then.
Again, it was episode 3 of the Weekly Stuff podcast, which was then called WGTC Radio, was the last time we talked about these movies. And I know I've watched the first two Raimi films a couple times since then, because I love those movies. But now we are talking about Spider-Man 3. I have to say, when we were planning this series, doing these episodes and thinking about this, this is the one I was kind of most excited to do, because my thoughts on the first two films are fairly settled. I think they're great. I think Spider-Man 2 is especially great. I never know what to think about Spider-Man 3, because my default position is I don't think it's as bad as its reputation, but I don't think it's good necessarily. And I will say, watching it again the other night, I definitely mostly still think that. It is nowhere near as bad as its reputation. There is a long list of much worse superhero movies than Spider-Man 3. But this is a bad movie. I think it's a bad movie. Its redeeming qualities are the carryover things from the first two movies, not anything specific to this film, really. It is an absolute mess of a film. But I also think it's a fascinating mess. And, 11 years on from its release, Spider-Man is, nice and healthy in our culture again. We've got video games and movies and comic books and TV shows doing Spider-Man very well. The trauma of there being a less good Spider-Man movie. There was a much less good one in 2014, so hey, we've gotten over that. And now I kind of find it fascinating. But I am not, unlike our Star Wars prequel discussions where we were kind of setting out to critically rehabilitate these movies as much as we could. I'm not doing that. This is not a movie worthy of critical rehabilitation. It's not a good movie, but it is an interesting one.
I continue to have extremely conflicted feelings on Spider-Man 3, which is how I was before I watched it again. And I am even more conflicted on it now in that I don't know if I agree that it's a bad movie necessarily. I think it is undeniably an incredibly messy movie. But I also had a really fun time watching it. I think it is the kind of thing of, I think it does not have a cumulative impact at all. And there are fucking storytelling things in the movie that are just absurd. I don't even know if there's we have interesting new ground to break on that. It's there are three villains in the movie. There should not have been three villains in the movie. There's way too much stuff to deal with.
There's three villains who have absolutely nothing to do with each other in any way,
exactly.
Shape, or form.
Yeah, so there. It basically does feel like you kind of stitched three films together, but it has, a really solid cast. Even the new Thomas Hayden Church is awesome as Sandman in the three scenes that he gets, and he's fun. And they're great scenes. Probably is actually now on rewatch. That's probably the part of the movie that most should have been cut in an earlier phase, because it's that is the part that has the least to do with anything else. Even if I think it's probably the best part. But anyways. I think it, in the moment, the scene-to-scene, Sam Raimi-ness of it, I still enjoy so much, and it still has this incredible sense of humor and life and personality to it, even behind like the studio kind of like trying to force in Venom and that kind of stuff on top of it. I think there are still there are things that Sam Raimi does with that material that is very interesting to me, and I was kind of able to see this time a little bit more of like visions of what, like, if he had focused on Venom, like, there are things he does with Venom in this movie that are way more interesting to me than I ever gave it credit for in terms of some of the horror chops he brings to it. Again, it's very abbreviated and not developed in any way. But there are, like, bits and pieces in this movie that I think are so interesting and so much fun to watch that even if it's certainly not a great movie, I had so much fun watching it that I can't call it a bad movie for me.
And I totally get that. And bad might be a little harsh, because if I were doing, like, a letter grade for this movie, like I used to do sometimes when I reviewed films, this is probably a C or a C-minus to me. A C or a C-minus is probably not a bad movie. It's not a good movie. I don't think this is a good movie. There's any way to defend it as a good movie. It is one of the most structurally broken Hollywood films I've ever seen. Like, if you try to trace a three-act structure onto this thing, it is so utterly bereft of structure. I mean, Topher Grace is introduced 34 minutes into this movie. Like, I have all these, like, time markings of just, like, how broken the structure is.
The fucking symbiote does not attach to Peter until halfway through the fucking movie. That blew my goddamn mind, because I thought for sure that had to happen in the first 30 minutes, and I had totally forgotten. That's like the halfway point of the movie is when the symbiote attaches to Spider-Man.
So yes, this movie is structurally broken beyond repair. It is shattered in terms of structure and narrative. Yet, I agree with you that moment to moment, it's fun to watch. It is eminently watchable. It is a well-made film. It is a well-put-together film. It has character to it. This is not like, you know, Amazing Spider-Man 2, which is our perennial kicking bag for Spider-Man because it deserves to be. It's horrible. Like, Spider-Man 2 is both structurally broken, it's also thematically devoid of any worth, it is morally devoid of any worth, and it is directorially devoid of any sense of style or pace or put-togetherness or anything. It is just incompetent as a piece of filmmaking on every single conceivable level, whereas Spider-Man 3 is not on every conceivable level. On some levels, it's very bereft of skillfulness, I would say, like in the script. But the acting is very good when it's... I think Tobey Maguire struggles in this one because I don't think the story has a sense of what his strengths and weaknesses are at all. Or what Peter Parker... who Peter Parker was in the first two films. And I think they betray that character pretty fundamentally throughout this film. So I think he has some issues that are not his fault. But the acting is still very solid. There are some really fun sequences. It's got great music. It's got amazing special effects. Yes, there are a lot of good things in it. And I also think one of the most striking things about it to me is that if you just map out the themes of the movie, like, what did it want to impart to the audience about Peter Parker and Spider-Man and his world? I think it had the right themes. I think it had the right idea in mind for what you do as a third film in this series as a follow-up to Spider-Man 2. I think it executed that narratively very, very, very poorly, but it has the right ideas, it has the right cast, it has the right director, and it is such a surreal experience every time I watch it. Because it's like going into Bizarro World. It's like, what if the first two Spider-Man movies just didn't come together? Because none of the pieces have really changed. It's all the same pieces on the chessboard, but now they're putting together and they're just not working. And it's always in the back of my head, like, the series is Spider-Man 1 and 2, and the end of the series is Mary Jane watching as Spider-Man goes off and to fight another day. The go-get-him tiger ending. And this movie is like a weird what-if thing that fell out of a fucking wormhole into our world of, like, this is the world where the Sam Raimi Spider-Man series just didn't work. And it is so incongruous with the other films in so many ways. But it makes it one of the most fascinating superhero movies, I think, ever.
Yeah. But another quality of it that is very interesting to me is that there is, like, as you're talking about with the theme stuff, there is a certain, like, clarity to the theme and like the themes of the movie that still, like, it technically works. I don't think it experientially works that well, But there's like a, like, I don't think there's any mistaking like what Peter Parker's character arc is. I don't think his character arc is messy in a way that is like, I can clearly identify it. I can see how it builds and develops. It's like, I think it experientially is very messy in terms of, you know, you don't ever spend enough time focused on it because you're cutting through all this other shit all the time. But that's the kind of quality that like a Batman v Superman or Amazing Spider-Man 2, I have no fucking clue what Superman's character arc was supposed to be in Batman v Superman. You know, like it's so messed up. It's so all over the place. There's never a sort of like stayed hand, like sort of being like, okay, this is what Superman needs to be. It changes all the time. Or like Amazing Spider-Man 2 with all the fucking like parent stuff. Like all that stuff throws like all this like smoke into the themes and like the core storytelling premise and the character arcs that makes them like cloudy and unclear and confused or self-contradicting. And Spider-Man 3 doesn't have that issue to me, which is one of the places where it's like, it's functional on levels that like you wouldn't expect it to be given the other levels on which it is totally dysfunctional.
Yes, but I agree with a lot of that, especially comparing it to like the superhero genre in a lot of ways has gotten at its, when it's good, it's gotten better since the 2000s, since the aughts. When it's worse, it's gotten much worse to me. When it's worse, it's gotten even more soulless and vapid and devoid of technique when you get into something like a Batman v Superman or a Suicide Squad or an Amazing Spider-Man 2. That's, those are nadirs lower than I think we had pre-2010. But we've also had some movies that are, you know, generally higher than, like, the average superhero movie. We've never maybe gotten back to, like, Spider-Man 2 or Dark Knight, I think, in this decade. So I agree with a lot of that, that there are some things this movie still has a fucking heart, you know? Like, that is yes. Important. It has a heart. You can feel the heart beating. But I think it's maybe got a pacemaker put in there that's, like, really heavily malfunctioning because, I mean, theme and story do have to go together, and one of the main themes in this is revenge and Peter letting go of things. And the most baffling thing about how long it takes to do something in this movie, it is over an hour before the plot point that Sandman killed Uncle Ben is introduced into this film, which means the core theme resolved at the end of revenge takes almost half of the movie to be introduced, and there's not even any structural justification for that, because that could have been the opening of the fucking movie, is the flashback to Sandman killing Uncle Ben. Like, James Cromwell could have sat Aunt May and Uncle Ben, or and Peter down at any time in the movie and done that, and they put in an hour into the film. Like, there's just things like that where, I said this the other night on Twitter, it feels like they decided on some themes, and they were good themes, and then the people who wrote the movie, which included Sam and Ivan Raimi, got together in a bar and played the exquisite corpse game where they just made the story up as they went along and wrote it down on cocktail napkins, and that was the shooting script. It is so baffling to me as a piece of storytelling.
Yeah, although I would disagree that like the main, that revenge is the main theme. I feel like revenge is a subcomponent of like the theme of Peter getting full of himself and arrogant and feeling like he is on top of the world, and the revenge is part of that, of feeling like he has the right or the authority as Spider-Man to just go out there and take revenge and take out this guy. I feel like that's what I mean, where it's like, it's functional in that way of like, I can look at it that way in like again, on a more of a technical level than a like butt in the seat, like really like enjoying the experience of watching like the flow of the movie. But on a technical level, I think there's stuff it does with Peter's character arc that's like, that works. Like, that all technically, like, you hit the boxes, you check the boxes, maybe not all in the right order, maybe not as strongly as you needed to, but you do them. And it's like, it's weird to me, because I feel like usually a movie wouldn't, if it was messy in all these other like pacing ways and structure ways, it wouldn't even be able to like see the boxes, let alone check them, you know?
I get that. I mean, the end of the movie, the penultimate scene of the movie, is Peter forgiving Sandman for killing Uncle Ben, forgiving Harry and being forgiven by Harry, and then forgiving himself. So like, you know, forgiveness and absolution and moving on are big themes. And just because if revenge is a sub theme, which I agree, it's probably a sub theme to the main theme, it's still a sub theme that should be there in 20 minutes, like minimum.
Yes.
Or like maximum 20 minutes into the movie. Like, that has to be something Peter is thinking about. Like, the first hour of this movie mostly could be cut. It's mostly like just wheel spinning nonsense. And that's what I mean, like the cocktail napkin thing. It's so weird, because I agree. On one level, thematically, I think this movie is very clear-headed in what it wants to say. And then there's the story element, in that it's as non-clear-headed as it could be. And I agree that it can work. It totally does work technically. Like, I'm actually always surprised by how much the end of the movie moves me, even though it really should not have any cumulative impact. It kind of weirdly does. There's a lot we could get into here. This is a complicated movie to talk about.
Yeah. So let's dig into it. Where do we want to start, Jonathan, on Spider-Man 3?
I've got a lot of notes here. One thing I put in my notes is while we're at the top of this, I want to read a quote from Roger Ebert's review of this movie, which is just a sublime piece of writing where he's just clearly kind of like frustrated and bored by this thing, which I understand. And I love this. This is like the penultimate paragraph of his review. He said, "Spider-Man 3 is, in short, a mess. Too many villains, too many pale plot strands, too many romantic misunderstandings, too many conversations, too many street crowds looking high into the air and shouting, 'Ooh, this way,' then swiveling and shouting, 'Ah, that way.' And saints deliver us from another dinner date like the one where Peter plans to propose to Mary Jane. You know a movie is in trouble when the climactic romance scene of the entire series is stolen by the waiter, Bruce Campbell. And poor Aunt May, an actress of Rosemary Harris's ability, asked to deliver a one-note performance, and that single note is fretting." I think about that paragraph on like a weekly basis. That thing about too many people looking up and going, "Ooh, ah," I think is one of Ebert's best sentences ever. And I think it actually touches on a lot of the issues with the movie.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. It's something of like the quality of the whole movie is that there's so much stuff. Because it's also important to note that this movie is the longest of any of these by like a good 10 to 15 minutes.
About 15 minutes.
Yeah, so it's the longest of these three movies, but like everything in it feels like it has to be so abbreviated because there's so much shit going on that like anything it does has to be cut short, and like the legs are kind of cut under every single plot point. Every single scene in the movie has to like it has to stop before it fully develops whatever it's trying to do, because it needs to move on to the next thing, and then the next thing has no real connection to that, and then the next thing after that has no connection to it. It's like this very confusing chain of scenes, particularly I think, as you said, the first hour is especially egregious at this, of being like, that is the part that feels like there are three different movies like literally stitched together. Or the other thing it reminds me of is it feels like it is, you know, I think we've talked about this in regards to some other movies, of like it feels like the weird anime compilation movie that they do sometimes of here's like the 20 episodes of Mobile Suit Gundam that we cut together and do like, you know, maybe 5 minutes of original animation to sort of stitch scenes together. But what you're really getting is about like a third of a television season that's kind of edited haphazardly into a movie. That's kind of what Spider-Man 3 feels like. What if Spider-Man got the Marvel Netflix TV show, and then you had to take that and take all the footage from it and make a 2-hour movie out of it? And it's like, well, this is what we got. We've got three villains, and it's all over the place, and it's ridiculous.
The only problem with that analogy is every season of every Marvel Netflix show would almost certainly be better cut down to 2 hours. Like, there's no doubt in my mind every one of them would work better in that format than at 13 episodes.
Okay, what if it was three seasons of a Marvel Netflix television show that you had to edit to 1 2-hour movie?
Because the filler to good stuff ratio in those shows is like 99-1 at a certain point. I saw Jessica Jones season 1. It had like 2 hours of plot, maybe, in 13 episodes. No, I agree. I agree with that completely. I could totally believe that there is a good 13-episode season called Spider-Man 3 that has Venom and Sandman and Harry and all this other stuff and is great, and this is like the weird cutdown of it. I could believe that. But like, here's some examples of narrative sloppiness, because especially comparing it to what we've been talking to over the last 2 weeks with Spider-Man 1 and 2 is I'm so impressed every time I go back to 1 and 2 at the narrative economy of those films, at how things happen at a good clip, but with real like character momentum to them too, so that things don't feel like they're just happening at random or are disconnected. It really feels like a movie that is thoughtful and thought out, and every sequence has place and purpose within the film. Here's how this one starts. The symbiote thing, which I think is thematically appropriate, and we'll talk about that later. I think the symbiote needed to be in this movie. But plot-wise, how is the symbiote introduced into this film? It literally just lands on Earth right next to Peter and MJ at complete random without even a sketch of an explanation, and then it bonds with Peter a full hour later. Like, that couldn't, we know nothing about it, that couldn't be sloppier. The Birth of Sandman is Thomas Hayden Church is running out in a field, we don't know where, we don't know why, he falls into a pit where scientists are doing something, and that's it. That's it, he just becomes Sandman at complete random. Like, for a series that had up to now been pretty thoughtful about its villains and their connection or lack thereof to Peter and, like, what made them the way that they are, and that, again, character motivation was everything to these movies, there is zero motivation for the existence of Sandman or the symbiote in this movie. And I would even say, like, that, I mean, the Harry stuff is one of the worst examples of this, because Harry apparently has spent, like, 3 years in between Spider-Man 2 and 3 just brooding, I guess, and then at random one night he decides to attack, and then they're like, you know what, Harry, we really can't have you in the plot right now, we're gonna give you amnesia, we're gonna pull a 24 season 1, and just, we're gonna conk you on the head for a couple of episodes here, and it's just, it could not be a stronger contrast to me between, like, Doc Ock in Spider-Man 2, scientist, idealist, meets Peter, has a bit of an ego, thing goes wrong, he becomes Doc Ock, he has a goal, and it contrasts to Peter thematically and narratively this way, versus Sandman escapes from prison, needs money for daughter, falls into a pit, has sand. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it's because it's exacerbated because, one, you know, the movie, since the movie has to do all three of those, the movie has to do, introduce the symbiote, introduce Sandman, and reintroduce Harry as, like, the new Green Goblin. It has to do all three of those things. So none of those things get, like, the time and attention each of them need, because you could totally craft a whole thing with, like, you could do the thing that, like, some of the cartoons have done and use the John Jameson character as an astronaut to introduce the symbiote, because you can bring him back from Spider-Man 2. There's a whole thing you could do there, but you can't spend 10 minutes setting that up at the beginning of this movie if you also have to do Sandman and Green Goblin. For Sandman, you could spend a lot more time, like, establishing him as who he is before he ends up getting his powers, and maybe, like, some connection to whatever the fuck scientists are doing in the middle of the woods with a big pit of sand and a big spinny thing. I don't know what they're doing. That was an element of this movie that struck me very strongly this time, of like, what the fuck are they doing with this big city spinny thing with a bunch of sand in the middle of fucking nowhere? What are these scientists doing? And how come they don't realize, you know, how come they don't notice that, like, the little bit of extra weight that got added to the thing is 200 fucking pounds of dude? Like, it's not a bird, asshole. It's a really weird, random scientist line of, like, oh, it's like a bird landed on this. No, I'm pretty sure Thomas Hayden Church is a little bit heavier than a bird, and you'd probably notice in your delicate science experiment with sand. And then, you know, then you have to do that, and you can't give it enough time. And then, of course, you have the Harry Osborn stuff where, because I want to talk about the fight scene between Peter and Harry at the beginning of this movie that I think is, and I say at the beginning, it's like fucking like 30 minutes or something into it. But, like, I think that scene on its own is really awesome, and I love seeing Peter out of the suit doing action stuff. I think it's a cool dynamic. But that's the end to a different Spider-Man movie that you're watching at the beginning of this one, of like, oh, the confrontation has built up between Peter and Harry, or it's at the very least the middle, like, act two action scene of another Spider-Man movie where finally Peter and Harry have to butt heads, and Harry comes and swoops in and attacks Peter. That's not, like, the second scene that Harry Osborn is in a movie. You can't just have him swoop down and attack Peter Parker. That's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, there is a conversation to have here. Much as we love Spider-Man 2, they so clearly backed themselves into a corner with the end of that movie and, like, what they do with Harry, where I it's pretty obvious there was no plan for this. It was, we're going to set this up here, this seems like it'll work, and we'll figure it out later. And it's pretty clear to me when you get to Spider-Man 3, Sam Raimi is not interested in dealing with Harry Osborn as a character in this film. He does not want to do the Hobgoblin thing. He does not want to do the plot that was suggested at the end of the last film, so they literally just amnesia it away until it's convenient to bring it back much later in the movie. Like, that is one of the most egregious pieces here, and the weird thing is, I think it could totally work. Like, I was watching this and I'm thinking, okay, themes I like. You know, I think starting with Peter kind of at the top of his world, that's good. Having him confront Harry, who is his best friend, but there's been this tension with him on his Spider-Man persona, that's good. Having the other villain being a petty criminal, you know, Sandman, instead of like criminal mastermind, I think is an interesting idea. Dealing with the symbiote, all these interesting ideas. The way I would do that, though, I'm watching this as like kind of like the Spectacular Spider-Man series where Oscorp sort of creates all these villains that come after Spider-Man that season. Like, the way you would do this is have Harry, like, running Oscorp and having a vendetta against Spider-Man sort of from the shadows and not have it out in the open. And the way you bring Sandman into that is that he would, like, get a prisoner out of Rikers or something and be like, hey, I'll give you your freedom if you do this science experiment with me. Turns him into Sandman, sets him loose on Peter. There you go. Now we have character motivation, and it's all tied into one story, and now it's not two completely disparate villains. It's one story going on. The symbiote could be something similar. It's something in the lab, or it's something that John Jameson brings home, and Peter is the photographer at the event, and the symbiote bonds with him there. Like, there are all sorts of ways you could have tied this together. I do not think it's impossible for all these elements to be in one movie and work. I think it totally could work. It's just, they've totally, it feels like they threw all these plot elements into the fucking ceiling fan and just let them kind of land where they lay.
Yeah, no, I basically agree. I think it's, I agree that it's not that it's impossible to make a movie that has all of these elements together, although one element you left out of that was, of course, Venom, that you also have to introduce and have him be at the end, if you're including all the elements that Spider-Man 3 feels it has to include, whoever, you know, the people involved that made all those decisions. But I think it's like, that's still, it's not the choices you should make. Like, you shouldn't have all of that shit at the same time. Like, it's even that, I think, is too much for, like, a movie is not super suited to, because those characters are not going to be fleshed out no matter what. Like, you can't deal with all that stuff and then have Peter and have MJ and have Aunt May and deal with, like, all the continuing character arcs from the previous movies. It's so much to deal with. But one choice that this movie makes that is, on this watch, became very inexplicable to me is the Harry Osborn amnesia. Like, I don't have an issue, like, you know, intellectually with Harry Osborn getting amnesia and forgetting he's Green Goblin. That is literally what happens, like, five times in the fucking comic books with both Norman and Harry, because they find out that Peter is Spider-Man, and so, of course, the only way to resolve that is either kill the villain or have them somehow forget that Peter is Spider-Man and that they're the villain if you ever want to use them again. So, yes, Harry Osborn has amnesia multiple times. Norman Osborn has amnesia multiple times. Amnesia, Harry Osborn, totally fine with. Whatever. But in this movie, there's basically no reason to do it other than to get the scenes, and I think they are well done for what they are, of having Harry be, like, the friend again to Peter and MJ. But when you get to the point that then Harry, like, remembers what he is and then has the good scene with, you know, Willem Dafoe reprising his role, and I always forget that Willem Dafoe is technically in all of these movies, even if he dies in the first one, where he, you know, he reprises that line from the first film, you know, we attack the heart, and then Harry Osborn has the idea, oh, I'm going to use subterfuge to attack Peter, not, like, violence. Why isn't that just what he does at the beginning of the movie, and then throughout the movie he's doing that and pretending to be Peter's friend while he's actually attacking Peter's heart, and you find out that actually Harry Osborn has been, like, an asshole the whole time? Why isn't that what it is? Why does he even need to get amnesia if he's going to remember who he is and then pretend to be good anyways the next time, and then, like, to hatch a secret scheme? What is that? Why would you do that?
Yes, I completely agree. I think there is absolutely a version of this movie that where you could, maybe not everything this movie tries to do, but you could do a lot of what this movie tries to do if you tied it around a central theme of Harry Osborn is using subterfuge to attack Spider-Man. The only problem with that is, again, they are so boxed in by the end of Spider-Man 2. If you've ended Spider-Man 2 with he knows definitively Peter Parker is Spider-Man, I don't know if you can go right into subterfuge confrontation. Like, you certainly can't have the two-faced Harry Osborn thing, because it's all out in the open between these two at this point. So,
you could at least have him, like, tell Peter that he forgives Peter, and, like have that scene
you could do
in the movie where it's like they reconcile and you think everything's good, and Harry knows that Peter is Spider-Man, but he's accepted that, and Peter is, like, you know, as part of, like, Peter thinking that he's on top of the world and everything's working for him, when in fact he's so blind by his own arrogance that he doesn't see that his friend is trying to betray him, you know? Like, that so jives with the movie to just
I actually agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, I think it would be a little bit messy because it's like, you know, the reconciliation thing is something you'd expect later in a movie, but you could fucking do it and it would be fine. Like, it would be much better than the path they choose to go, which is to try to do three different plots with Harry Osborn at the same time.
I actually think that would work really well because, ironically, as dumb as the amnesia thing is, I do think this is the best use of James Franco in these three movies. I think he's got the best performance that he gave in the Spider-Man films is in Spider-Man 3. I think he feels the most human in those scenes where he has amnesia and is like with Mary Jane and with Peter. And I think it would be, that would actually have been a fascinating way for this movie to go if the start of the movie is Harry forgives Peter. Peter thinks he has his best friend back. Mary Jane thinks she has this friend in her life again. And you could use that for all these different means. And it's almost like he's a James Bond villain in the background, like moving all the pieces on the chessboard. That would be fantastic. And that would be such a good use of James Franco.
Yes, and then there would be so much more impact to the classic James Franco scene where he eats the pie and goes, "So good."
That is probably the hardest I laughed in all three of these movies. Is
it's so good?
It's amazing. It's just amazing.
Oh man,
it is like Sam Raimi must have come up and been like, "Okay, here's my direction. You're gonna eat that pie. You're gonna say so good, but the feeling I want you to have." Is that you are orgasming while you are saying this. Can you do that for me, James? That's all I do, Sam. I can do that.
Yeah.
And he ejaculates all over that pie, metaphorically.
Yes, indeed. You know, he projects the actorly atmosphere of ejaculation on the pie. Yes, yeah. I agree.
I mean ejaculate in the sense of like Charles Dickens or something. Or Arthur Conan Doyle, where Watson is constantly ejaculating all over Sherlock Holmes, but it's in the sense of he is saying things enthusiastically.
Yes, of course.
And so, in the fan fiction, realistically too. All right.
Okay.
So what did you want to talk about something?
Well, while we're talking about the Harry Osborn stuff, I do want to go back and zoom in a little bit on the scene I talked about where Harry attacks Peter, even if it is bizarre and absurd to me that is like his second scene in the movie. It's such a cool scene. It's such
really
a cool
well
fight. And there's something, it calls back to some classic Green Goblin stories. Like, I think it's John Romita Sr.'s first Green Goblin story after he takes over from Ditko is the one where it's Norman, not Harry, but Norman has remembered and figured out that Peter is Spider-Man and shows up basically in Queens on Peter's doorstep as Green Goblin, and Peter has to fight him without being Spider-Man and has to like throw on his web shooters and he's just in his normal suit. I just love whenever Peter Parker has to go into action without, you know, being prepared and without having the Spider-Man suit. One thing they miss is that they always make sure to do in the comics is since, you know, Peter can't use his wall crawling stuff with his feet if he has his shoes on because his shoes are too thick. He always has to take his shoes off and tie the laces together and like throw them around his neck and is like, well, I just got to do this thing. It's an element of that look I've always liked a lot, but they really capture something about that taking Peter by surprise and he has to jump into action immediately. Really catches me with that scene. And then I think just the choreography and the movement of the action is really well done. And it's like Sam Raimi has so much experience with directing these very effects-heavy superhero fight scenes that even if I think like the dumb sword and like fucking flying snowboard that Harry has is technically dumb, they're used really well. And the sound design on that, the hoverboard and all that shit is really cool. And I think like, again, in terms of like the larger storytelling purpose, the scene is bad. In terms of like the, like if I watch that scene on YouTube, I enjoy the hell out of it.
No, and this is ultimately what separates Spider-Man 3 from the really bad superhero movies, is that there are several, many in fact, isolated sequences in this movie that work very well on their own. In context, they might not. In context, sometimes they do. Like, I think that is a fantastic action sequence, and its choreography is really good. It's a very unique presentation of Spider-Man on screen, and it's very well done. Does it play into a stupid plot? Sure. But I do think there's a lot of well-done stuff there. I think, you know, that's a really good scene. I think the birth of Sandman, where he's, like, coming out of the sand, and there's the... I really like the... We should talk later. This is not a Danny Elfman score. It's Christopher Young. But I do think the music is still very good, and the Sandman theme is great. That's just a phenomenal effect sequence. It's a really... Like, if you pulled that out on its own and just told me it was a weird avant-garde movie, I'd be like, that's actually a pretty cool little short film, you know? I think that one works. I think there's a montage we're going to get to later that is A plus Sam Raimi, F minus Spider-Man, but you know, it's as its own thing, it works fucking beautifully. And I actually think the entire climax to the movie, it is the most manufactured climax possible. It comes at, like, literally you can hear in the background someone going, it's time to wrap this movie up, let's get a final confrontation going.
We have to abduct Mary Jane in this movie, like, let's just do it.
And yet, the filmmaking of that sequence is really good. I think the filmmaking of it is well done. The aesthetic, how it's put together and shot and choreographed is often thrillingly done. So there are all these sequences that work. I do think the connective material, a lot of the, like, nuts and bolts, as much as there are nuts and the rusted nuts and bolts of the movie, plot stuff feels anemic. It feels like no one's heart is really in it. I think there's a lot where you can feel Raimi and company just kind of coasting. You can tell Kirsten Dunst is kind of frustrated with the material because she's given a horrible part in this movie. You can tell Tobey Maguire is struggling to modulate what exactly they want out of him because Peter Parker is an asshole in this movie, and Tobey Maguire playing an asshole is just not, doesn't really gel. That's not who he is. And there's moments where it really feels like the movie is trudging along on a death march. But then you will get these moments where, and sometimes it's because Raimi and company go, fuck it, we're going to do whatever we want for the next 5 minutes, and we are going to actively rebel against the movie we are making. And that is what that montage sequence is to me later on, the Peter dances silly in the street montage. But the movie will burst to life every once in a while. But I do think, like, it is notable how many scenes in this movie do feel like just a trudging death march. And I actually think nowhere is that more clear than maybe in a lot of the scenes with Aunt May, which I hate to say because I love Aunt May and I love Rosemary Harris. But, man, the contrast, like, if you watch any of her scenes in this and then put on, you know, any given scene with her in Spider-Man 2, it feels like two different series. Like, it just feels like they don't know what to do, and that happens a lot in this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I think, yeah, because Aunt May has, like, two, maybe three scenes in the movie, and they, all of them feel basically perfunctory. All of them could more or less be cut, and you would, you know, more basically be fine and get the gist of it. The other side of the movie that I feel the strongest with in terms of that, of like, this is the most cookie cutter, like, soulless, that you don't care what's happening in the sequences and in, like, story beats, is basically everything to do with the Gwen Stacy character in this movie is so just like, I don't get that there needs to be a love triangle, but I get that they are trying to put a love triangle in the movie, I guess. And so you evoke the Gwen Stacy character vaguely and do that. But it's just like, the execution is so weird to me. On both, like, the Spider-Man fan level, this is the one movie out of the three of these that feels the most like, this has fucking nothing to do with Spider-Man. Like, this has nothing to do with Gwen Stacy. Obviously, some of the symbiote stuff is pulled more directly when you get, like, the church scene. Like, that's fine. But other than the symbiote stuff, like, you know, I'm fine with how they redo the Sandman character, but the Sandman character's backstory and all that stuff is totally different. The Harry's relationship with Peter is so unrecognizable from what it was in the comics at this point. You can't really see it in there. Like, MJ and Peter's relationship is different. Like, I feel like there's something about, you know, and I don't think it's like the movie, Spider-Man movies need to hew very closely to the source material. Comic book movies typically don't. But it's very markedly different in this movie, the way it handles some of that returning material or adaptive material. And the Gwen Stacy stuff is the most stark of, like, I don't know why you're doing this on 500 different levels.
It couldn't have anything less to do with Gwen Stacy. I always, in writing, just call her fake Gwen Stacy. I've done that for 11 years now. She's fake Gwen Stacy because it could not have anything less to do with any given incarnation of that character. And it also is the element of the movie that most clearly you could pluck right out of the film and you wouldn't notice it. It's so superfluous on every level. And I mean, it's weird because it's not like they got a nobody to do it. It's Bryce Dallas Howard. James Cromwell plays Captain Stacy. This feels like you could have gone somewhere with it. But yeah, Bryce Dallas Howard, who is famously a redhead also, which is like, it's like one of the most prominent things about her in every other movie she's ever played. And so they cast her for Gwen Stacy. That's always kind of, because she doesn't look real blonde. It's a stupid thing to note. It doesn't matter. It's shallow. But it's like, it's the fakest, like, blonde, either hair dye or wig. I don't know what it is. Because she's a ginger. It's weird. Like, she's who you would cast in a different world to play Mary Jane, not Gwen Stacy. But, like, it's not just that it's unrecognizable from different source material. It's unrecognizable from the other movies. Like, when I see Peter Parker and Mary Jane in this movie, and I see Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst sharing the screen, they don't feel like the characters from the other two movies. It just fundamentally, there is such a disconnect there, because Peter Parker is, again, Peter having ego problems after years of being Spider-Man, good story idea. I think that's an interesting direction. I'm sure this wasn't the first time anybody did it. You can tell us all about that in a second, but like, it's an interesting idea. Peter randomly becoming the world's most insensitive boyfriend and getting a complete character transplant is an amazingly bad execution of it. I mean, Peter is so insensitive in this movie. He literally cheats on Mary Jane with fake Gwen Stacy in front of the entire city of New York. He recreates the most iconic, like, probably etched into their memory moment of their relationship with this random chick in front of all of New York City, and then has no awareness or idea of how or why it might be a problem while he's trying to propose to her. He won't even try to listen to her about her play. He fundamentally in this movie does not care about Mary Jane Watson. And if there's one thing we know about Peter Parker in the first two Spider-Man movies, is he cares about Mary Jane Watson. He couldn't give less of a shit about her here other than as this thing he wants to own. And that is not something the movie seems aware of. That is not like a conscious theme they're dealing with. Because again, him having ego problems and being a little aloof is different than him basically emotionally abusing his partner and then at one point literally hitting her in the face, which also is just a horrible dramatic choice.
Yeah, it's something of where I almost wish, I think, like, you know, wish is a weird word to use for it, but I think it would have, with what they have, been a stronger choice to actually lean into that side of it even more and have the story be about, like, maybe Peter and Mary Jane aren't, you know, soulmates or whatever. Like, maybe that's not how, maybe it doesn't work out for them. It's like, you know, they were high school sweethearts. Like, he had a crush on her since she was 6 years old. Most people that have those kinds of relationships do not have those relationships for the rest of their life. Like, that's not how that usually works out. And it would have been interesting to explore that side of it if, like, they had leaned into it. Because there actually is enough material there to be like, no, like, MJ and Peter shouldn't be together by the end of this movie. Like, it kind of feels like they shouldn't reconcile. Like, there's no, like, he's gone too far.
He hits her across the face. I mean, he
even like
beats her.
I mean, even, like, cut that scene out and, like, ignore that part. Not saying that you should, but just, like, with, like, the less troubling dramatic material in the movie, it just feels like they've grown distant and apart in a way that feels like maybe they shouldn't be together. That's fine. There are other relationships that Peter Parker can have. There are other relationships MJ can have. Like, even if, like, they kept on making the movies, you could have done other stuff with it. Like, introduce the Gwen Stacy character to a point where it would have made more sense than just chuck her into this movie for no reason. But yeah, it's the MJ Peter relationship as it exists in this Spider-Man 3 is very confused, because it doesn't, like, it feels like it wants it to still be the romantic soulmate relationship and have them reconcile at the end and do that stuff that Spider-Man 1 and 2 does, but doesn't do it. Like, it just doesn't, like, know how to do that, handle that material and make Peter Parker an incredible asshole in this movie, because he is a fucking dickhead.
Well, and it's just, there's a larger problem with how Mary Jane is treated in this movie, where she is actively a victim of this relationship. Like, her life is being systematically ruined by proximity to Peter Parker, and the mere idea that she would not, like, run away from this guy at the end of the movie, let alone reconcile with him. Like, it is so tone deaf, I don't even know where to start with it. Like, she should have nothing to do with him. But that's not the series they were making. Like, I agree, you could probably do an interesting story arc with, like, Peter and Mary Jane's relationship dissolving. But I think you would have to do that in a comic book or a TV show or something that is ongoing where you could really, like, explore that. Because in a movie, we've done these two movies of them as soulmates. Nobody in the audience wants to see that. Nobody in the audience wants to see the, like, brutal dissolution of a partnership story that would be, you know, real and worth telling. But for, like, you know, 3 2-hour superhero movies, you just, the room for that does not exist. I'm sorry. It's just like, this is more on the level of almost like fairy tale storytelling when you're doing it at this length than it could be in a more serialized format. So everything about the relationship in this movie is wrongheaded, and I'm actually really surprised that when they were doing Spider-Man 4, the Spider-Man 4 that never happened, Kirsten Dunst was going to come back for it, and they were not contracted. They had to do new contracts with Maguire and Dunst, and I'm surprised she was even willing to do more of this, especially at that point in her career when she'd had a lot of critical hits outside of the commercial hits of Spider-Man, because, boy, as an actress, is she misused in this, not just misused, but underused, too.
Yeah. And this is the movie that has the by far most egregious Mary Jane kidnapping. It's so out of nowhere. Not only is it out of nowhere, it's utterly unnecessary. It makes no sense. Like, there's no reason for her to be kidnapped. Like, it could be any, like just have them kidnapped from like, a school children or something. Like, it doesn't matter that it's Mary Jane that Spider-Man has to go save. He just has to go save somebody. And it's just absurd that she just gets into a taxi cab that fucking Topher Grace is driving as Venom is like, well, I guess this is what we're doing. I guess the movie's almost over. Like, take Mary Jane and take her hostage, because that has to be the climax of all three of the fucking movies for some reason.
All right, you said his name, so let's talk about Topher Grace in this movie.
Edward Brock Jr.
I don't think Topher Grace is necessarily a bad actor in and of himself. I haven't seen anything I liked him in, but, you know, he was on That 70s Show, I think, and people liked him there, yeah. So who knows. He's horrible in this movie. The Eddie Brock characterization is horrible. It is so just clearly grafted on to a screenplay that did not ask that of it at any point. And again, Edward Brock, one of the main antagonists of this film, is introduced 34 minutes into the movie. 34 minutes. Like, you should be wrapping up the first act of your movie at 34 minutes, unless you're doing, like, an origin story like Spider-Man 1. Like, imagine if Spider-Man 2 did not introduce Alfred Molina for 34 minutes. How structurally fucked that would feel. And it is. It is structurally fucked. And it's not just 34 minutes in. It's at random in this totally out-of-nowhere action sequence, probably the most nothing action sequence in the franchise, of Gwen Stacy being in the building and a random crane falls and Spider-Man comes in and he walks up to Captain Stacy and takes pictures and he's like, I'm fucking your daughter. I'm taking a picture. I'm fucking your daughter. I know he doesn't say that, but that's basically the scene, and it's so bizarre that that's the way you would, like, yeah, he's the police chief, and I'm just going to randomly tell him while his daughter is hanging for her life from a beam that, yeah, oh, that's the woman I'm fucking. I wouldn't do that. I don't know whether her dad was the police chief or not. I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I think there's no way to argue that the Eddie Brock character is good or well done or useful to this movie in any real way. But this is where, you know, for a lot of the other stuff in the movie, when I say it's fun and I enjoy it, I'm not saying in a so bad it's good kind of way that some people might. For the Eddie Brock thing, that's where it's so bad it's good for me, in a way of like, I love the fact that he always... This is actually... Okay, this is intentional. I do love the fact that he always introduces himself as Edward Brock Jr. I don't know who made that choice. I don't know why. That's not a thing from the comic books. Also, like, this is another one of those where it's like, it's a very different... Eddie Brock in the comic books is this big meathead kind of reporter dude who's kind of a bit of a thug, and that is very far from what they're doing with him here. That's not a big deal, but I find it weird. He's so far away from anything I could identify as being Venom or Eddie Brock that it's like, that's why it's good that he's called Edward Brock Jr., because I can very easily silo him out as like, that's just a totally different, literally different character. But there's an element to him and the performance in the writing in this movie that I don't think this is entirely intentional, But particularly in that scene with Captain Stacy where we first meet him, it feels like if this movie was told from his point of view, it would basically be Taxi Driver. Like, he is fucking Travis Bickle. He is that guy. He's the dude that, like, when he is in his apartment, he's, like, standing there like this, like, you talking to me with a little, like, gun, you know, like holster thing. It's like, that is who this fucking Eddie Brock is. Like, to the point where, you know, it's such a ridiculous fucking scene when he's in the church and he's like, I only ask for one thing, for you to kill Peter Parker. It's like, who goes to a church and prays that fucking the Judeo-Christian God is going to kill a dude who proved that you were fucking plagiarizing his work? Like, that's so out there and, like, sociopathic and bizarre that it feels like he's going to end this movie, like, fucking going to a gang hideout and shooting five people. You know, like, that's what his story is before he gets the fucking Venom symbiote.
Well, now I'm sad we don't have Topher Grace in Spider Taxi Driver. Directed by Sam Raimi, just going crazy. That would be great.
But do you see what I mean?
Yes,
with, like, how awkward and weird and just, like, you know, it's like he that whole sequence of the Daily Bugle where he plagiarizes Peter's photo and then gets caught for it and he's trying to, like, sort of, like, schmooze around. It's just like, this guy's a fucking serial killer.
He's a fucking maniac. It is so weird because thematically, the whole Eddie Brock thing in this movie, the Venom thing, has to rely on Peter wronging him in some way so that the Venom thing also plays into this theme at the end of absolution and forgiveness and moving past mistakes. Peter makes no mistake with Eddie Brock. Eddie Brock plagiarizes and defames and potentially, like, jeopardizes the business of the Daily Bugle, and Peter is 100% in the right to expose him for that, and J. Jonah Jameson, like, needed to know that. Like, this is a business, this is a thing. He did a really bad thing. And the movie plays it like Eddie Brock is wronged, and like him going to the church and praying for the death of his rival from God, praying that, you know, it's like an Old Testament Yahweh will smite my enemies sort of thing. That's played like that is like the sane, sympathetic part of the movie, and it's not. He is an utter sociopathic monster. And so, again, it's just theme and story are so confused in this movie and have, like, theme is over here and story is over here, and they are not talking. They are not talking whatsoever in a lot of stretches of this movie. So, yeah, it's... I kind of forgot how extreme that whole part goes. And when he gets down on his knees and is like, God, I just want one thing. I want you to kill Peter Parker. I laughed so hard at that because it is such a left-field turn.
Yeah, it's just such a ridiculous fucking thing for a person to say and do. It's like, and not in the, like, comic booky way that some of the other characters are in the first two movies. Anyway, this is like, this is extreme and says things about this human being that we, like, this movie is not equipped to delve into.
No, Edward Brock Jr. is not a functional human being on any layer of reality, even the heightened comic booky reality of this movie. Like, he's, like, J. Jonah Jameson, we can believe being a person in this world. You cannot believe Edward Brock would be a functional member of society in the world they have built.
Yeah.
So, oh man. And then all the stuff with him as Venom is, like, you do have to feel for Topher Grace with just the doofy, stupid CGI makeup he has on in the scenes where, like, the Venom mask comes off and he's talking and he looks like... Like, a lot of the makeup in this movie is bad. Like, all the goth makeup Peter Parker has on is so horrible. But all of those effects with him as Venom are just laughable. It is... Because it looks like he has, like, those fake vampire fangs you would get at, like, a Halloween shop in. And you can tell he's got, like, a lisp or something because he can't talk through the weird dentures they've put in. I can't believe that made it to release. It's hilarious to me.
Yeah, it's also something of where I just don't even... I don't understand why when the Venom symbiote takes over Eddie Brock in this movie, why we ever need to see Eddie Brock again. It just kind of feels like that was something I was thinking about at the end of this movie. Like, what things could you cut down to still have, like, all this shit, but have a more manageable movie? It just kind of feels like, why not just have the Venom symbiote be its own thing and just attack Peter after he separates from it? Like, why does Eddie Brock even honestly need to be in this movie? Because one of the things I do like about Venom, and it kind of has nothing to do with Venom in this movie, is the way that Sam Raimi uses some of his horror chops in that last fight scene. I think there's like some good, you know, they're not like jump scares, but you know, he's kind of like a surprising sort of like horror monster kind of character that he's made. And it's the kind of thing that, again, you know, is true about all these movies, is the way Sam Raimi shoots the villains is a lot more interesting to me than in most other comic book movies, because he brings that horror point of view. And nowhere is that more true than Venom, particularly a scene that I actually really like this time, is when the Venom symbiote is totally separated from Eddie and is in like the you know, within the like bars that are making the sound, and it's just totally monstrous, and it's basically like a scene from John Carpenter's The Thing. It's like, in that moment, I saw this glimpse of, what if Sam Raimi just like got to get to Venom on his own time and do it the way he would do it in its own movie, and it was more like that, and it was more horror focused and more like extreme, that would have been fucking awesome. But unfortunately, it's just like he gets to do a little bit of that stuff in the last like 15 minutes of this movie and not able to develop it or do anything interesting with it as a film. It's just like, oh, here's like some interesting ideas on a take of how you do a more horror focused version of Venom in a Spider-Man movie. I would have been down for that, and unfortunately that's not really what we got.
So you asked, why did we still have to see Eddie Brock once he becomes Venom? I can tell you exactly why. It's because there was that scene in Spider-Man 1 where the Green Goblin and Spider-Man are on a rooftop having a full conversation in their masks, and there was a studio boss who saw that scene and wrote a note and said, never again. And by the time you get to Spider-Man 3, the studio clearly mandated, we are not going to have masks in this movie. Peter barely wears the Spider-Man mask in this film. Like, there are a handful of shots in the movie where Spider-Man is in the full suit. Like, this movie barely feels like a Spider-Man film to me at a certain point. Like, there are whole long stretches where I forget Spider-Man is in the fucking movie. And part of that is because when he does appear, it's usually Tobey Maguire's head in the Spider-Man costume. And that's not Spider-Man. That's Peter Parker cosplaying. Like, it doesn't feel right. And you see that consistently. It's also in the design of Harry's suit. It's very clearly there was a studio mandate of, like, we're not doing masks in this movie. And even with Venom, who, it's not a mask, he's a fucking alien thing, they were like, no, you've got to find a way to show Topher Grace. We paid, you know, this X amount of money to get him in our movie. We're going to have his cute, you know, face in the film.
Yeah.
So, that's why. Yeah. Let's see. Okay. I want to talk about my favorite stretch of the movie, which is, yes, and it's weird to say this is my favorite stretch because it is another structurally broken stretch, but at the 1 hour and 5 minute mark of the movie, the black Spider-Man costume is introduced. That is when Peter wakes up on the top of the tower and now he is in the black Spider-Man costume. The church scene where he gets rid of the costume is at 1 hour and 40 minutes. Within 35 minutes, we start, resolve, and end the entire symbiote arc. That is less than the time of a dramatic episode of American television. 35 minutes. That's barely an episode of, you know, Supergirl or something on the CW. It's nothing. But in those 35 minutes, you get the most fun, stupid, silly, and sometimes infuriating filmmaking in the movie. And it is also, you also get my favorite superhero costume, maybe ever. You get some really silly stuff, some really stupid stuff, and you get a point in this movie where my jaw drops and I'm like, the movie is actively rebelling against itself. These 35 minutes are the most fascinating part of this film.
I agree. And it is something where, again, since it had been so long since I watched it, in my memory, those 35 minutes are most of the movie. That's most of Spider-Man 3. It's like 1 hour to 1.5 hours of this film, because I had like totally forgotten about half the shit that goes on in this fucking film, or like remembered that it happened but couldn't reconcile it with any sort of like dramatic storytelling structure, that it just didn't like hold in my mind. And so it was that moment where it's like, the movie's going, it's like, man, that fucking symbiote shit still hasn't happened, huh? It's like, still going. It's like, man, he still doesn't have the black suit. He finally gets the black suit. And then you're right, it's like 30 minutes later, and you're at the fucking church and ripping it off your chest. It's like, how is... I don't understand how that happened. I don't understand how you do the fucking black suit story. You commit to let's like do the symbiote stuff, and somehow that's only really a 30-minute chunk of the film is Peter Parker actually having the black suit. Utterly bizarre choice.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh, well, but yes, but within those 30 minutes, you are 100% right. That is the most interesting, most fun, most ridiculous 30 minutes of the movie where it waffles between, you know, like sort of the high drama action scene of him fighting Sandman, which is fun. I think like there's a lot of fun actual like filmmaking with the way they shoot the black suit, and like there's good stuff there. Like I think it's a beautiful shot of him, you know, sitting on like the side of the Gothic church, like later in the movie, and it's raining. It's like great shot. Doesn't like the buildup isn't fully there to make that shot actually like, you know, deliver the emotional payload it should. But if you had, it would have been a hell of a fucking moment in the movie. But yes, you get everything with emo Peter going around doing his dance, fucking finger guns to all the ladies, hitting on Betty Brant, the jazz scene, all that shit that this movie was like ripped apart. And I get it in the moment in 2007 why people ripped that shit apart. Watching it now in 2018, so removed from that stuff, and it being such a like time capsule of that like moment when you had that kind of like that version of the emo subculture, I find it so fucking funny.
It's
an utter blast, and that's the part where it's like that's not it's so bad it's good. That's like that is what they were making. Like that you don't fucking deliver that comedy on accident. Like Sam Raimi was doing that shit on purpose, and it's fucking hilarious.
It's fucking hilarious. We'll get back to it in just a second. I wanted to make a couple points based on what you were saying just now. First, you weren't the only one who thought these 35 minutes were the whole movie, because that was the marketing of the movie. I remember right. I was so excited for this as a kid. Like, I was excited for this in 2007 in a way I generally don't get excited for things anymore, in a way adults generally don't get excited about life. Like, this was a big movie at the time, because Spider-Man 2 was so good. You wanted to see the sequel, right? And yeah. I remember all the marketing. I had the poster for this movie, full-sized poster, on my wall for years in my bedroom. And the poster is normal-suited Spider-Man, black-suited Spider-Man, crouching like as mirror images of one another. This movie was marketed completely on the symbiote black suit stuff. And I think that's one of the reasons it baffled people when it came out, including me, is that that's a tiny, tiny little chunk of the movie. It's half an hour. So that whole thing was just bizarre. I spent a lot of the last week researching and getting very accustomed to the theory of three-act structures in movies, because I was teaching this to a class. Because we're doing intro to film, and I do the discussion sections, and we were doing a week on narrative structure, and I'm going through the textbook, and they didn't have three-act structure. And I'm like, that's weird. That should be taught in intro to film. So I'm like, I'm going to do 20 minutes on it with them, and you know, you have to get pretty inundated with something if you're going to teach it in 20 minutes. So I've got this on my brain. I don't think you can map a three-act structure onto Spider-Man 3. I think it is too structurally deficient. And that's not because it's being artistic. No, it's trying to do it and it doesn't. But if you were to map a three-act structure onto this movie, the first act would be an hour and 5 minutes, because the lock-in of Peter's journey, the thing that defines the end of the first act, the lock-in, we're going on our journey, is getting the black suit, right? Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, 100%.
Yes. And the end of the second act, where there is a shift between like the main tension of the movie into the final tension, would be 1 hour and 40 minutes into the movie when he gets rid of the black suit and it falls onto Eddie Brock, because he's resolved the main tension, which is he overcame this ego problem he had. He shed it, and now he's going to try to rebuild his life. That roughly would be the three-act structure of this movie, is act one is getting to the symbiote, act two would be the struggle with the symbiote, and then act three would be it's shifted and now he has to fight it as an external thing instead of an internal thing. If you were making the Spider-Man symbiote movie, that's exactly what you would do, right? But instead, and this is why this movie feels so structurally deficient. This is why it's good to learn three-act structure. It helps you know when movies are doing something well versus when they're doing it poorly, is that would mean you have a movie with a 1 hour and 5 minute first act, a 35 minute second act, and then a 40-minute third act. And that is fucked. There is no movie with that kind of act structure where that would be justifiable in any way, especially if in that middle 30 minutes you're doing a big internal character struggle where, like, the entire world and its status quo is changing because your hero has, like, embraced his inner darkness. They do it in 30 minutes. It's hilarious to me on a structural level.
Yeah, because, like, correct me if I'm wrong, Jonathan, but typically Act 2 is the longest act in a three-act structure. Because it's like, you know, it's basically beginning, middle, and end, right?
So, yes, it either needs to be the... It's like, length is tough to define with acts, and this is actually a problem with a lot of modern movies, is short second acts. But how we define acts is by sequences. So you say there's two sequences in the first act, two in the third, and four in the second. The second act should have roughly twice as much plot content as the other parts of the movie. And the weird thing is, if you map the movie the way I just said, it does. Those 35 minutes have at least twice as much plot content as the first and third acts, but it's condensed into 35 minutes.
Yeah, it's absurd. Here's, like, one thing that I think really highlights it for me of, like, something that's so weird when you get to that stretch of the movie is that there is literally no sequence of Spider-Man being Spider-Man with the black suit.
Uh-huh.
Other than, like, obviously he fights Sandman. That doesn't count to me. That's different. There is no montage or just him, like, stopping a normal robbery. What you get instead of that is Peter showing, within the whole James Brown montage, him showing some pictures of him taking pictures of Black Suit Spider-Man to Robbie and J. Jonah at the Daily Bugle. That's the closest you get. I don't know how you do the Black Suit Spider-Man thing in a Spider-Man movie and not show, at, like, the beginning of the movie, him stopping a robbery as normal Spider-Man. That's, like, one of the first scenes. It's, like, a quick one of, like, here we reintroduce Spider-Man. Like, all these Spider-Man movies do this. And then when he gets the black suit, you show that same version of the scene. But, oh, God, like, he's so violent and aggressive. And you can see how it's changed him as Black Suit Spider-Man. You literally don't get any of that. He's in the black suit for almost no section of that 30 minutes. Most of that 30 minutes is him as emo Peter Parker walking around. And I enjoy that stuff, but you needed to do both of those things. You can't just have him be emo Peter Parker. You also have to show the fucking black suit some.
Yes, it's what you would want in the symbiote Spider-Man movie. And I don't know if you can do the symbiote Spider-Man movie and the Harry Osborn Sandman movie at the same time, because the symbiote has to go with Venom at a certain point. And the Harry Osborn Sandman, Mary Jane marriage drama, all these other things. There is thematic connection between all these things in the movie, but I just narratively they could not sit together because you need him in the black suit at the end of the first act, and you need that first act because it's your third movie to be relatively brief. Like, you need it to be 30 to 40 minutes of the film, and then you need to have a nice, good chunk in the middle where the majority of the action happens of showing how the status quo is disrupted by this major character shift with Peter Parker. That's what you would need to have. And then if you got to the end and Venom... Like, I actually don't think the problem is that Venom is only in 20 minutes of this movie. It's that Venom is only in 20 minutes of this movie after a really lopsided first and second act. Like, Venom being the third act plot shift is actually, I would think, a very savvy use of three-act structure if you did it right. They don't do it right. It could be a very savvy use of that.
Well, yeah, because if you had set him up in Act 1 and Act 2 more, instead of having a handful of scenes with Edward Brock Jr. that are all of them basically baffling, because you have to spend so much time setting up Sandman and Harry's stuff, you know? And it's like, and this is where we should also just, like, address some of the Sandman stuff, because I feel like even though, like, his scenes are memorable and the effects are great and Thomas Hayden Church is a great performance, like, he just, like, is in so little of the movie and he has nothing to do with the fucking black suit shit other than the, like, the very beginning of Peter having the black suit and fighting Sandman, which is also, like, not that long a sequence. You know, you have that whole long action sequence, like, one of the longer action sequences in the movie of Spider-Man fighting Sandman for the first time. And after that, Sandman's fucking out of the movie for so long. He's, like, Sandman is absent for the movie for, like, 30-minute chunks. And it's ridiculous, because then he comes back, you know, like, oh, right, Sandman's in this movie. And maybe the most severe is that, like, Sandman gets, like, turned into mud and washed out to sea at the beginning of Act 2, as we're structuring the movie now. And then you don't see him again until, like, halfway through Act 3, and he just shows up, and Venom's like, hey, buddy, come on, like, let's go fight Spider-Man. You hate Spider-Man, right? It's like, where has Sandman been for this whole fucking movie, it feels like? So much has happened, and he's been utterly absent.
The best part of that is when they cut back to Sandman, like, deep in Act 3 after all this shit, they cut, like, the thing with Black Suit Spider-Man just happened. Like, he's coming out of the drain where he was flushed down and reforming. That's how we cut back to him. And while in the narrative, weeks have passed, like maybe months, like a ton of time has passed. And Sandman is just like, the time of it makes zero sense.
Yeah. And so it's just like, again, it's something where I think all there's such an awesome Sandman Spider-Man movie with like the three scenes they made in this movie. And it's like, because I think so many people like myself have latched onto that stuff, and them adding the daughter as this motivation and having him be the, you know, involved in Uncle Ben's shooting. I think all those are really good ideas and the scenes work so well for me. But when I'm actually watching this movie, it's like, this has fucking nothing to do with anything, and you just don't, you can't spend any time on it. And so it's just, he's gone for most of the movie, and then he shows up, and you're like, every time I'm almost kind of bummed out because it's so disappointing how bad, how poorly used such an interesting version of that character is.
It could have been so good, because Thomas Hayden Church in this is so clearly in the mold of Alfred Molina in Spider-Man 2, where... Yeah. He's this character actor who would not be on the top of most people's lists to play that character if you just said, like, we're doing Doc Ock, most people would not jump to Alfred Molina, right? And if you said, we're doing Sandman, most people wouldn't jump to Thomas Hayden Church. And I think he could have been every bit as interesting a character as Alfred Molina's Octavius in Spider-Man 2. Like, I think there's a great Spider-Man movie to make with Thomas Hayden Church as this guy who turned to petty crime out of desperation, who Spider-Man keeps knocking down. And Spider-Man is like, it's an empathy lesson. Like, Spider-Man is not thinking about the people he's putting away and that there are, like, larger systemic issues going on. You could tell a great story with that. And I actually think the whole Uncle Ben forgiveness angle and revenge could also play into it in a really interesting way. Like, what's a more interesting third act for Peter Parker than to have to confront the humanity of the man who helped turn him into Spider-Man, who killed Uncle Ben? That's a really interesting idea. This movie does nothing with it. It has no time to do anything with it.
That's such a great idea for a totally different Spider-Man movie, because I have a very hard time trying to figure out how you would gel that stuff and do the symbiote suit stuff at the same time. Like, there's, because the symbiote suit demands so much material specifically to it, that's like, I can see some of what they do in this movie. I think there are ideas for how you can connect those two stories together. But God, there's nowhere near enough time. Like, that's the version that's in the TV show where there's like 4 or 5 episodes where he's Black Suit Spider-Man and you get to do all that stuff. In a movie, there's just no way you can connect all that shit together.
Yeah, again, go watch the first season of The Spectacular Spider-Man, which almost feels like a dare someone made of like, do Spider-Man 3 but good. And that's basically what The Spectacular Spider-Man season 1 is, with differences here and there, obviously. But like, it winds up doing the symbiote thing beautifully, just amazingly.
Yeah.
And actually roughly conforms to the three-act structure we're kind of talking about. So, as much as a TV show can. So, yes, that's all. So there are the structural problems. Now, Sean, let's have our dessert. Let's talk about the montage. The montage. The montage that is set to People Get Up and Drive Your Funky Soul by James Brown, which if you haven't listened to that song, get on Spotify or Apple Music right now and type in People Get Up and Drive Your Funky Soul and listen to that song because it's fucking great. And yes, this is the montage where Peter, after throwing a grenade in Harry's face, which is a little extreme.
I love that the movie never addresses that until, again, like halfway through Act 3 where Harry Osborn's there with his scarred face. It's like, there's no scene of him in the hospital. There's no scene of him, like, you never revisit him again until it's like, Like you'd assume he's just dead until they just randomly cuts to Harry Osborn in his apartment. It's like, oh, I guess he's alive. The movie never let me know that he survived a fucking explosion in his face.
Yes. But this is the scene where Peter is walking down the street doing his finger guns. He's dancing. He's got his horrible, like, goth emo makeup on where he's got, like, you know, clearly, like, white blush on his face, and he's got, like, dyed black hair, and all the women on the street think he's really lame, and he's going into the Daily Bugle and flirting with Elizabeth Banks in one of the purest, best pieces of comedy I've ever seen in a superhero movie, which is Elizabeth Banks leaning up to Peter and going, "Peter, your shots are so good." And then J. Jonah Jameson says, "Miss Brandt, that's not the position I hired you for." That is, yeah. is fucking A plus. That's actually followed by Elizabeth Banks is looking through the window at Peter putting his feet up on Jonah's desk. And she just has this like grin of like, "Oh, he's so brave." It's like, it's very funny. You get that. You get Peter with the, woman from across the hall at his apartment, Ursula, where he's having her feed him milk and cookies and then makes her go make cookies with nuts. He's like being the most banal douchebag, and it is so funny. I think Tobey Maguire is 100% in on the joke, and overall this whole sequence to me, maybe even more than like the Dr. Octopus horror scene in Spider-Man 2 in the hospital, this might be an even purer expression of Sam Raimi's id.
Yeah, it's so out there. It's like it feels like Sam Raimi like got away with something with being able to put the "Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head" montage in Spider-Man 2, and he's like, "Oh my god, people just like let me do like that." You do realize I ended that montage with a fucking freeze frame, right? Like, okay, I guess people accept that. And so he's just like, "Well, how can I just do something even like exponentially more ridiculous?" And he came up with this because it is, I mean, it's amazing. Like, it's honestly, I think, an incredible bit of filmmaking. Like, the montage and the editing and, like, the music. You know, I think you can have your issues with whether or not you want this, like, version of Peter Parker and you want this sort of story told with the character. I have no issue with people not liking the scene on that level. Like, I think that's fine. And I especially get not liking it when it came out and has how heavy a contrast it is with, like, the version of the character in 1 and 2. But again, in 2018, with like expectations set and knowing what you're getting into and like taking it at face value and letting everything else by the wayside, it's so much fucking fun to watch. It's just like, I want to watch it again right now because it has such an energy and life and humor to it. And the way that everybody just like all the random extras in the background just fucking hate this douchebag in the middle of the street dancing with his stupid fucking emo hair that is already like 2 or 3 years out of date by 2007. It's so funny and it's so good.
And when I say this movie is, or this sequence is Sam Raimi's id, the thought experiment I want you all to do is close your eyes, picture that montage, and replace Tobey Maguire with Bruce Campbell.
Oh, I'm right. Oh, holy shit. Especially the scene with him and Ursula and he's on the phone with Kurt Connors and Connors is like being very serious about like, "Oh, the symbiote suit. This is really interesting." And then he's just on the phone. It's like, "Let's check off this jack off." That is vintage fucking Bruce Campbell. You are 100% on the nose there, Jonathan.
If this sequence were in an Evil Dead movie, if there was like a somehow Evil Dead, like, where, I don't know, the Deadites get into the city or something, and he's, like, corrupted by them. He wouldn't even have to be, because Ash is just a douchebag. Like, that would be, like, everyone's favorite scene from Evil Dead 4, or whatever movie it would be in. Right? Like, it would be vintage Sam Raimi, Bruce Campbell stuff.
It really does feel like Tobey Maguire, like, went up to Bruce and is Bruce talked him through this scene. It's like, how do I play a douchebag? And obviously, it's sort of emoed up to, like, fit Tobey Maguire's, like, body type. But other than that, it's fucking Bruce Campbell. Like, you are so 100% right with that. Holy shit, I never saw that before.
Well, because, you know, I've been watching the Evil Dead movies, and I just watched Evil Dead 2, which is where it gets Evil Dead, you know, it gets the Evil Dead we culturally know, and the Bruce Campbell who is, I mean, he's Bugs Bunny in that movie, like he is just this crazy ball of silly putty, and you know he had and some of the like ego, you know, Ash stuff you get more in Army of Darkness, but like I was watching that, and then you know I go watch Spider-Man 3, and it's just on my head, like. Because Bruce Campbell is his muse. Like, that's, I feel like that is the actor Sam Raimi has in mind for a lot of characters, even though, like, he obviously can't make Bruce Campbell Spider-Man. That would be entertaining, but no studio would make that movie. I still think that's kind of the ideal he has in mind for a lot of his comedy. Like, we talked with last week with the, in the hospital scene, the guy who says, "Anybody here take shop class?" he totally, in his head, I have to imagine Bruce Campbell is the guy he sees in his head when he looks at that scene on paper, even if it's not the actor who's there.
You're 100% right, because it is like they have that working relationship together, and Bruce Campbell has such a specific sort of swagger, and it's because Bruce Campbell plays that kind of, like, you know, Nathan Fillion, almost kind of Harrison Ford-esque, like, you know, Indiana Jonesy, like, I'm the hero that's also like charming male hero that's also a bit of an asshole, but it's like just like off kilter just a little bit is the Bruce Campbell version. It's just like, because it's like he's especially just like, no, you're just a douchebag. Like, he like falls into like, you're just a douchebag, Ash. Like, come on.
I wrote this down the other day when I was watching Evil Dead 2, where I said Bruce Campbell is a 30s or 40s like matinee movie star who went off his meds. That's what he is. He's like, so anyway, but yes, this sequence, Tobey Maguire walking down that street, doing the finger guns, and then coming out. I love he goes in, and they do this jump cut of him going into the store, coming out of the store with the stupid black suit on, and he starts dancing. And the context that everyone forgets about this scene, too, is that I love all the extras on the street who are giving him this side eye of, like, this is the stupidest douchebag we've ever seen. Like, it is so self-aware. I think people make fun of this sequence as if it's like, man, they had no awareness of what they were making. They thought that was cool. No, they don't. It's a goof. It's a parody. It's complete, like, silly nonsense. I wrote it in my notes of, this is the scene where the movie stages a full-scale rebellion against itself. Like, it's not in place for this film. But it is very funny.
Yes, and it is. I cannot have anybody impugn the filmmaking talent on display in that scene. Again, I'm fine with you not liking the storytelling stuff around it, but the sequence itself is just awesome. I love it.
And again, like, J. Jonah Jameson is not in this movie much, but Miss Brandt, that's not the position I hired you for. That might be his funniest line in all three films.
Yeah. Although there is, we skipped over an earlier scene with J. Jonah Jameson where he's taking his meds and Betty keeps on buzzing him because, you know, he has the heart medication. That's just a fucking skit. Like
it's great.
It's really good. It has the great fucking punchline of he finally gets the right bottle and opens it up, and then she buzzes him again. He spills the pills all over himself. It's very good.
Oh, that's His Girl Friday. Like, that is a 40s screwball comedy done perfectly.
Yes.
I do like Elizabeth Banks is only in the two scenes in this movie, but they clearly knew by 2007 that she's Elizabeth Banks, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, how she is used in this movie is much more like she is movie star Elizabeth Banks, who is very funny, and I think that whole thing is just done very, very well. All right, and then you get, after that, the jazz club scene, which is frankly even crazier in a lot of ways. And it ends with the horrible moment where he beats Mary Jane, and I don't like that. Up until that moment, though, this is the part where it really feels like they have just decided, fuck it. Let's forget the story. Let's forget the whole Spider-Man thing. Let's have Toby goofy dance, and let's have him play jazz piano, and let's just go, like, weird abstract with this. And it is the most surreal stretch of this movie, is that weird-ass jazz club scene. And I think the, like, hitting Mary Jane at the end of it is both, like, the ultimate culmination of how far off the rails we are. And, I mean, I guess that's my point. It is, like, the ultimate culmination of, like, we're so off the rails, and then we hit the plot again. And when those come together, you realize how far away from the heart of this thing we've landed.
Yeah, definitely. It's something where it's, like, when you get to that jazz club sequence, which, again, I think, like, the filmmaking on display and how that whole, like, dance is put together and everything is, I just love it, and it's got an energy to it that's just, like, fucking ridiculous but great. But it is something where it's, like, it's so bizarre and so extreme that it really does feel like, at the end of it, Peter should wake up in his bed in, like, cold sweats from, like, you know, he never even got the symbiote on him. It's like he just fell asleep listening to the police scanners or whatever trying to catch a Sandman. He's like, oh, fuck. Oh, that was weird. You know, like, that's what it feels like, is it's basically a literal dream sequence. But, yeah, it's a weird scene in terms of the story. But fuck it, it's so much fun to watch up until the very end.
It's no coincidence that Raimi immediately after this one went and made Drag Me to Hell, because there are scenes like the jazz club scene and some of, like, I think the visual stuff with Venom and Sandman, where he so clearly wants to go make a silly horror movie. He wants to, like, go make something where he can, like, bend reality more. You know, like, his kind of, like, Evil Dead, which is like a, if Looney Tunes was a horror movie, you know? Like, he wants to do that again, and then he got to go do that again, and he got it out of his system. But, like, he's at war with himself in Spider-Man 3, because there's no justification, like, aesthetically for that jazz club scene belonging in this film or this series. But it totally makes sense if you think, like, yeah, Sam Raimi's been making these for 7 years at this point. Like, and I, you know, you assume, I mean, actually it's true, Drag Me to Hell he wrote in the 90s and was trying to get financing through the entire Spider-Man trilogy to go make that movie. And it's like just pieces of that are like coming out, you know, the corners of this film.
Yeah, there's definitely a restless Sam Raimi behind some of those scenes. It's like, I gotta make some weird shit, guys. I gotta get out of here and make some weird shit.
All right, before we go on to the end of the movie, speaking of Bruce Campbell, we did forget to talk about his cameo in this movie. I might have to rescind what I said last week in that Spider-Man 2 is his funniest cameo. I laughed harder at his Spider-Man 3 cameo. Part of that is I have a well-documented, you've heard about it on this podcast before, weakness for silly French accents. It comes from the Pink Panther, but I love it in many other areas. The movie Muppets Most Wanted with Ty Burrell doing a funny French guy in that movie with the Muppets. I think about that all the fucking time. I love Bruce Campbell's funny French accent in this. Like, white Americans doing funny French accents will never not be funny to me. And I have a soft spot for it. But also his physical humor in this one. Every time Peter, like, accidentally calls for the ring. And then he's like, no, no, no. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, it's very funny. Like, his French accent is just ripped straight from Pink Panther, and it's great. Like, I've never seen Bruce Campbell whip that one out again for anything else. If you want to see Bruce Campbell give a funny French accent performance, Spider-Man 3 is, as far as I know, the only place you can go for it.
I was watching it, and I'm like, I don't need anyone to do another Pink Panther remake, but if they did and they hired Bruce Campbell as Inspector Clouseau, I would watch the fucking shit out of it.
Yeah, and there is something of where, like, Bruce and Toby have such a, like, refined comic timing at this point. This is, like, their third time doing one of these little bits together that I think on, like, a technical comic level, I think this is definitely the funniest of the three. I think in terms of the storytelling, the first cameo is, of course, the best of him being the wrestling announcer. But if you just want to watch one of these scenes on YouTube, isolated from everything else, I think this is probably the one for the comedy.
It also, in terms of the, like, headcanon that this is the same guy in all three movies, it's definitely the funniest because you can kind of, they even play it as, like, Tobey Maguire recognizes him, and he's like, "Your friend," he's like, "I am French." And it's like, it's so clearly this guy is not actually French. And I just love the little story that is told in these three movies of the wrestling announcer who lost his job wrestling, became an usher at a theater, lost that job, and started working at a French restaurant basically being an imposter of an actual Frenchman.
Yeah, and I do like that in this one. I like that we get one cameo scene where Bruce Campbell's character likes Peter and has fun with him. Like, because the other ones, he's just, like, poking fun at him the whole time. And this one, and maybe this is, like, the greatest insult of all to Peter Parker is that actually this douchebag likes him and is like, "Ah, I like you, kid." Like, but yeah, I like the dynamic of this scene is a bit different than the others.
Is there anything else we should say about the end of the movie? We kind of touched on the big final confrontation, how it kind of comes out of left field. It's got a bad kidnapping. I do like the way he defeats Venom with, like, the sound bath he creates and the sound cage. That's kind of cool. Harry's death kind of gets me choked up a little bit just because it is a solid culmination in some ways of this three movie journey, even though that character was not consistent. Like Peter letting Sandman go makes sense on a character level, but I also think that's extraordinarily irresponsible of Spider-Man to let this, like, mass murdering, criminal back out into the world with horrific superpowers. So, you know.
Yeah. I think I love the idea of, like, this other, again, like, it's kind of like every sequence of this movie. Like, I love the idea of the other movie that was just this movie, but of the movie where Peter and Harry, like, fight and then by the end have to team up together. There's a cool dynamic there that I like, and it's like, I think there are these glimpses of a, like, character dynamic for Toby and James Franco to play that this movie skirts around that, like, would be interesting if it was committed to, like, a full film. But this movie doesn't have all that. So it's like there's, again, when you cut back to Harry Osborn in his apartment and he's, like, horrifically scarred, it's like, this is weird. Like, it's weird that we haven't seen this character since. And it's really weird that to revisit the idea that, like, Peter Parker just threw a fucking bomb in his face and then now they're, like, teaming up. There's just nowhere near enough story material dedicated to, like, that relationship to make, to buy any of that happening. But again, on, like, if you throw all of the larger storytelling problems out of the way and just, like, go by the moment-by-moment, like, filmmaking and, like, the story presentation, I agree with you that, like, when Harry dies, it is an affecting scene to me. And when Sandman dissolves away into the sunset, like, that's a beautiful little moment. But the movie doesn't culminate in those moments having, like, narrative real impact.
No. So it is a very weird ending, and then it has this scene at the funeral, and then it just ends with Peter and MJ sort of kind of making up. It ends very abruptly, honestly, overall.
Yeah.
Because they don't have much time left to deal with, because the movie went on forever. Yeah, I don't know. Spider-Man 3, man. This is a weird fucking movie.
It's a weird fucking movie. It's definitely an incredible mess. But it, again, I have to stress, I enjoyed the experience of watching it tremendously. And I laughed a lot. I enjoyed a lot of the action. I was confused at a lot of different parts. But I will watch this movie again someday. This is not a, like, you know, Batman v Superman that you couldn't pay me to watch that fucking movie again. It's like, I want to watch Spider-Man 3 again in, like, 5 or 10 years.
Yes. You know, I maybe come down harder on this movie than you do. Neither of us is arguing that it's, like, secretly great or anything.
No.
But let me rant for a second. I still see this fucking movie held up all the time as, like, it's the worst superhero movie. This is the worst third movie. This is what a bad sequel is. People rip this movie apart all the time. If you really think this is that bad a movie, you haven't seen that many movies. Period. Like, that's just the truth. That is objective. That is not my opinion. There are so many worse movies than Spider-Man 3. And this is the one you get so fucking obsessed with. I don't get it. Even if we, let's just, there's lots of bad movies. Let's just contain it to superhero movies for a second, Sean. And I'm narrowing it down even further than that. These are specifically DC or Marvel adaptations. Tell me if you think any of these should be considered better than Spider-Man 3.
Okay.
Superman 3. Superman 4. Supergirl with Helen Slater, the one no one remembers was made. Batman Forever. Batman and Robin. Catwoman. Ang Lee's Hulk. Daredevil. Elektra. X-Men Origins Wolverine. Jonah Hex. Ghost Rider. Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance. Green Lantern. Fantastic Four 1994. Fantastic Four 2005. Fantastic Four 2015, Amazing Spider-Man 2, Batman v Superman, Suicide Squad, Justice League, and, I assume, Venom.
Yep. No, those are all bad. Honestly, like, also, while I think Amazing Spider-Man 1 is a more competent movie in terms of, like, the story sense, I would rather watch Spider-Man 3 again than watch that movie again, because Spider-Man 3 has more, it's more interesting. It's got more, like, when it has those moments that work, it works for me in a way that, like, Amazing Spider-Man 1, like, the highs are so mellow that it's like, I don't really need to ever see that movie again.
I would watch Spider-Man 3 over Amazing Spider-Man 1 because Spider-Man 3 is connected to Spider-Man movies I love, whereas Amazing Spider-Man is connected to a Spider-Man movie I hate. I do think Amazing Spider-Man is unambiguously a better film in most ways, but yes, and I'm sure I'm forgetting superhero movies on here. You could go at least 20 movies deep with this genre. And other than Supergirl, none of those are particularly obscure, the ones I just named. Okay, Fantastic Four 1994, I'm cheating a little bit. That's the Roger Corman one. I just think it's funny to remind everyone that there have been 3 movies called Fantastic Four, and they're all terrible. But yes, like, you, without even getting into obscurities, there are so many worse movies in this genre, and a lot of them have been since Spider-Man 3. Like, you know, if you really are still harping on Spider-Man 3, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is right there. It is infinitely worse. It's worse in every way. Suicide Squad is out there. Suicide Squad is the worst movie I've ever paid to see. Like, you know, I like superhero movies. They can be really good. They can be really fucking bad. And Spider-Man 3 is not really fucking bad.
Yeah, if anything, I think one of the things that causes it is, like, the gulf between Spider-Man 2 and Spider-Man 3 is pretty tremendous. And so I see this, like, if you're saying, like, it's one of the most disappointing sequels, I would kind of agree with that. Of, like, movies that I like in kind of, like, more modern films, I would say it's, like, among the most disappointing sequels I've seen. But disappointing and, like, dog shit are two different things, yes. Right?
Like, this goes more in the zone of Spider-Man 3, The Dark Knight Rises, X-Men The Last Stand, X-Men Apocalypse, like, movies that are not bad, but, like, Dark Knight Rises is probably better than all of those, but, like, in this kind of middling range of, like, you didn't know how to execute a sequel, basically. Like, the treading water yeah. sort of thing, you know? It's, yeah, I just, because I also think people let this movie reflect back on Spider-Man 1 and 2, where you do see, I do think that the popular opinion, like, on the internet these days is that the Sam Raimi movies are bad. You see that all over the place. Like, people love making yeah. fun of these movies. They rip them apart. Mostly they're talking about Spider-Man 3. Like, like when people make fun of Tobey Maguire, they're never talking about scenes from the first two movies. They're always talking about scenes from the third film. And I hope if we've done anything with these three podcasts, it's to remind people that as problematic as Spider-Man 3 is, it's an island. It's over here. It has, like, nothing to do with the first two movies. The first two movies are so good in so many ways. I think they still have so much to instruct us about this, you know, dominant Hollywood genre right now. And they should be watched and celebrated. And then Spider-Man 3 should be watched and puzzled over.
I mean, it's got a good fucking Bruce Campbell cameo. And that's a lot more than can be said for almost any other superhero movie.
Yes. All right. Well, we'll be back next week. We're going to talk more Spider-Man for our fifth fucking episode in a row, because we will both have beat Marvel's Spider-Man for the PS4 by then, I think. If not, something will have gone horribly wrong with me, because I don't want to tear myself away from that game. And we'll see where we go from there.
Excelsior.